The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On the show this week...
In some ways, the financial markets were kind of trapped by their own invention. You know, they were trading this stuff, even if tomorrow everyone said, oh, the equation's no good.
Mathematician Ian Stewart joins us for an extended interview on the equations that he says change the world. The fabric of our lives are constructed from these algebraic inventions, from wave theory to the Fourier transform. And from established algebra to brand new ideas. In the news this week, why upper-class people tend to behave more badly than others, and a new report on how good the UK government is at taking advice on science. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Hello and welcome to the programme. In the studio with me this week is a man who's made doing and talking about maths into an art form. He's a prolific scientist and author, and is a recipient of the Christopher Zeeman Medal for his work in promoting mathematics. We last had him on the podcast to talk about the emerging new mathematics of biological systems. Ian Stewart is now back to talk about algebra. His latest book is 17 Equations That Changed the World, and he uses algebraic expressions to explore a broad sweep of the great scientific and mathematical ideas that lie hidden under our everyday lives. I started by asking him to begin at the beginning, about where the idea for equations came from in the history of mathematics.
Equations go back a very long way. The ancient Greek geometers, more than 2,000 years ago, were actually working with equations, although they worked with them in terms of the shapes and the lengths and kind of geometric interpretation. And the one everybody knows is Pythagoras' theorem. And what the Greeks would say is that if you have a right-angled triangle and you look at the longest side and put a square on that, then that square has the same area as squares on the other two sides put together. But we now write that algebraically as a squared plus b squared equals c squared. One side squared plus another side squared is the third side squared. And of course, squared is this operation, take a number and multiply it by itself.
So very simply there, you can see that an idea that is almost geometric becomes algebraic. And that's how, when you start getting equations, when you can start manipulating these terms and conditions.
The great thing about an equation is it tells you that two apparently different things are actually the same. So it's a relation between things. So for the triangle, it says if you've got a right-angled triangle, you can't have three completely arbitrary numbers for the sides. Once you've chosen two of them, the third one is determined. So you can use it to calculate the third side given the other two. So you can use equations to calculate new things in terms of old ones.
And so a Pythagoras theorem, I mean, this is something we all learn at school, I hope. I don't know what maths education is like these days. But I hope we all learn it. How powerful is it, this very simple equation?
It's enormously powerful. If you look into the history of what happened to the equation, it was the first step towards trigonometry, which is a mathematical technique for working with triangles. Given a triangle and some of its sides and some of its angles, work out the other sides and the other angles. And everything in trigonometry is really based upon Pythagoras' theorem in some form.
In the book, you've chosen 17 equations and you describe them all, but for my mind, they seem to be in two types. So there's Pythagoras, for example, which is a fundamental mathematical idea or useful tool to then build into bigger theories. Because I mean, Pythagoras' theorem has been used by generations of scientists afterwards to come up with things like gravitation, theories of space and time, which sound so far away from just drawing triangles, but you know, many steps removed. Let's talk about those other equations next. So you've got things like calculus, logarithms, square roots of minus one. These aren't equations as such, more tools, aren't they?
They're equations that define mathematical objects, or they tell you things that are true, basically. You know, Pythagoras' theorem is a true statement for the geometry of the plane of a flat sheet of paper. It's not true on a curved surface like the Earth, but it's a kind of mathematical fact. But the other kind of equation, and in many ways certainly equally important and in a way more informative, are equations about the real world, the equations of mathematical physics, Newton's law of gravity. The gravitational force between two bodies is proportional to the masses of the bodies and inversely proportional to the square of the distance between them. The further apart they are, the less that force becomes in a very specific way. Now, that is an equation about the physical world. It's not a mathematical fact. It could have been different. The law of gravity might not have been like that. In fact, according to Einstein, it isn't quite like that. But that equation encapsulates the rules, the laws of the physical universe, and then you analyse the consequences mathematically. So yes, it's a very different kind of equation. And most equations are either mathematical facts or statements about the real world in some mathematical form.
And at some point, experimental science, experimental natural philosophy, whatever you wanted to call it before it became science, started to become mathematical. You needed these equations to define the ideas that people were coming up with. When did that sort of start to happen?
I think equations came into mathematical physics, into science, the kind of equation that is a statement about the universe. That the story there is essentially the one that goes from Kepler, Johannes Kepler, looking at measurements of the positions of Mars in the sky, the planet Mars, and doing calculations and working out that the orbit of Mars is an ellipse. And then Isaac Newton says, now I can explain that ellipse in terms of the force of gravity acting between the Sun and Mars. And so Newton writes down an equation for how gravity works, solves the equation, finds out what numbers you plug into it to make it work, and comes up with an ellipse as a consequence of that equation. So this is the point at which the mathematicians and the physicists realize that if you write down mathematical equations for the laws of physics, for the rules that nature is using, you can then use mathematical methods to solve them and deduce things that match observations.
And make predictions. So mathematics started to become very useful for physics around the time of Newton and Kepler and Galileo, and has never looked back, really. New equations come along, they're more complex. One of the other things that Newton did, and with a fractious debate with Leibniz, of course, the German mathematician, was come up with calculus. Now, how useful is calculus to the progress of science?
Calculus is one of two or three contenders for the most useful mathematical idea of all time, I think. It really is extraordinarily important because for several hundred years after Newton, the main progress in physics is writing down calculus equations for how the physical world works. And calculus basically says what's important is not just the quantities you measure, but how fast they're changing. It's about rates of change. So Newton's laws of motion say the acceleration of a body is determined by the force that acts on it. Now, acceleration is not where the body is. It's not even how fast it's moving, which is the rate of change of where it is. It's the rate of change of how fast it's moving. So it's a rate of change of a rate of change of position. And calculus is like that. And the point is, in those terms, the law becomes a very simple statement. If you try to go straight for a description of the position of a body under forces, it's so complicated it doesn't really help.
And it's only momentary anyway.
That's right.
If you try to do that.
Yeah, you just can't. It's not the right way to think about it. The pattern in the laws is on the level of the acceleration. It's the acceleration that obeys simple rules. And then you use mathematics to work out where it goes and how fast it does and where it's going to be at some given point in time.
We'll hear more from Professor Ian Stewart in just a little while, but let's take a break and look at some of this week's science stories. Joining me is the Guardian science correspondent, Ian Sample. Welcome, Ian.
Hi, Alan.
Let's go for a very serious and potentially very exciting story about gene therapy. Just last week, there was a very interesting case study of gene therapy, curing or helping the immune system of a young boy. Tell us a bit more.
So this was some work out of Great Ormond Street Hospital in London, which focuses obviously on children. It was the first use of a new kind of gene therapy where they're using a new virus to get a corrected version of a gene into some immune cells, into the immune cells for a boy that had a pretty rare immune condition whereby as you grow up, it's an inherited condition. As you grow up, you can fight viruses pretty much okay, but your immune system has a problem with it that means certain cells that attack bacteria and fungi don't work properly. So pretty early on in life, you tend to hit the hospital with a serious fungal infection or bacterial infection, and gene therapy is an alternative way to try and treat this. The only cure for it, proper cure around at the moment, is a bone marrow transplant.
And so this disease, it's called XCGD, chronic granulomatous disorder. As you say, the only cure is a bone marrow transplant. This particular boy couldn't find a match, or they couldn't find a match for him. So what did they actually do?
That's right. Well, this guy is a 16-year-old lad, and he was treated last year in June 2011. Now, his brother inherited the same condition, was treated with a bone marrow transplant. But there's a group run by Adrian Thrasher and some others at the hospital where they have previously tried to treat this condition with a gene therapy that uses the viruses that were the same kind that we use in the SCID kids, the bubble boy kids. And as everyone will probably know from those trials, there was a small number of the children ended up developing leukemia as a result of that. Now, what happens in this treatment is they've developed a virus which should be more effective and crucially safer in that it shouldn't make cells cancerous and treat the disease that way.
And the success was that this boy's immune system was raised for temporary periods, and he actually was able to fight off the fungal infection he'd had for a couple of years.
That's right. So this boy had for a couple of years a really serious lung infection, and you can only do so much with antifungals in giving those as a treatment. And this, what the treatment seems to have done is it boosted his immune system only temporarily.
So it's not a cure.
It's not a cure at all, but it was it boosted it long enough to get him over this one infection. Now, you know, finding something more permanent, a permanent way of treating this could be, the answer could be you do heavier chemotherapy. So you destroy more of the patient's existing bone marrow stem cells that go on to make the immune system. So when you inject corrected ones, the cells that have been corrected by gene therapy, they're more likely to take root and dominate when they multiply in the body, so that you do actually recreate a healthy immune system rather than just have a small number of cells that are working properly.
Let's move on to a subject which is close to the heart of this podcast, especially recently, which is scientific advice to government. And we did an entire program about this recently, looking at how science can be used to improve public policy making. And the House of Lords issued a report last week looking at something similar, but specifically about the chief scientific advisors in the various government departments. Ian, the report was broadly welcoming in saying that there was good scientific advice in government, but it had some specific problems that it highlighted. Do you want to take us through some of those?
That's right. I mean, the Lords Committee took it upon themselves to get advice and get evidence from former chief scientific advisors, people like Paul Wiles, who was the former chief scientific advisor for the Home Office, and a lot of other senior figures who have held those positions, and just talk to them about their experiences. Was their advice sought in issues of policy where there was a scientific element? Was their advice taken? You know, their advice not necessarily will and should be taken in every case, because science isn't everything, but it was an exploration of those issues and whether they faced, you know, any obstacles in getting their job done, essentially, because the Government Office of Science says that chief scientific advisors should be at the core of what is done in those departments. Now, what they heard a lot of good stuff, but you know, there were buts, and they had evidence that I was talking about Paul Wiles, the former Home Office chief scientist. He didn't hear that the Home Office was thinking about bringing in biometric ID cards until it came up on the radio in the morning when he was getting out of bed. And another one of the chief scientific advisors said he, when offshore wind farm policy was being developed, he wasn't given access to the people who were doing the policy making, so he couldn't offer any engineering advice. We know that when the government decided to close the Forensic Science Service, the Home Office didn't ask its own chief scientific advisor to get involved. And so there are these things are serious, and there are very stark examples where advice is not sought from these chief scientific advisors, or their advice is essentially brushed aside.
Well, one of the crucial things that came out of the discussions we had on our podcast a few weeks ago is that chief scientific advisors are not just there to tell you what the scientific ramifications of something are, but to challenge ministers. I mean, again, the ministers don't have to take that advice and accept it, but the fact is that the scientific advisors should feel empowered enough to have access to the ministers and not feel like they are just civil servants towing a line. I mean, there's an example in the Lords report where Bernard Silverman, the Home Office CSA, his chief scientific advisor, felt it wasn't his place to say anything about the closure of the Forensic Science Service, which seems like an odd thing to do.
That's right. I mean, the House of Commons Science Technology Committee last year criticised him for not seeming to care that he had been sidelined by this, by the Home Office, which is truly awful. And one of the issues that the report raises is it says the people you bring in for chief scientific advisor need to be, first of all, absolutely internationally, nationally renowned in their fields. They need to have really good links with academia and industry. You should not appoint a career civil servant, as the Treasury did last year in James Richardson.
Well, quite. So the Treasury didn't have a scientific advisor for a long time. Then it appointed one, and everyone thought, great. But this man was, what, an economist?
That's right. Yeah, absolutely. He has a PhD from the London School of Economics. He's obviously incredibly knowledgeable and informed and very good at what he does. He's director of public spending at the Treasury. But he already has a big job there. And this the Lords report, Lord Krebs, I spoke to about this, said their committee saw this as essentially just a labelling exercise. What the Lords committee wants to see is a chief scientific advisor working part-time, say 3 days a week on this, spending the rest of the time in academia, in industry, so you keep those links. So when you need to get the advice you need, you have that network, you're plugged in, you're not some, obviously excellent, but still civil servant person who probably doesn't have the same kinds of networks to draw on. And you need the seniority and the clout of someone who can come in and say, we can sort this out, and to challenge directly these people above them.
And someone who doesn't worry about their jobs for that same reason. Speaking truth to power will sometimes get you sacked, as Professor David Nutt found, even though he wasn't a civil servant or even employed by the government. Clearly, there's room for improvement there, and we'll keep on to that story as it develops. Final one, though. It's one of these studies which you think sort of people probably intuitively know, but it's probably a bit prejudicial to talk about. But I'm going to read you the second paragraph, and then I'll let you go on from there. It says here, privileged people behaved consistently worse than others in a range of situations, with a greater tendency to lie, cheat, take things meant for others, cut up other road users, not stop for pedestrians on crossings, and endorse unethical behaviour. Do you want to take us through where those conclusions came from, Ian?
Absolutely. Well, this was a spectacular raft of experiments. There's 7 experiments done in total by a group led by Paul Pifford at University of California, Berkeley. And it was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. And his group started out by... they've done an awful lot of work looking at are there class differences in the way people behave, especially with respect to other people and so on. And they started by looking at using people's cars as a proxy for their class, if you like. And it's quite a good symbol. I mean, people in flash cars tend to be, a bit posh. And it's the way it is. If you see a ridiculous SUV in Chelsea, then the chances are it's not going to be, someone like me driving it. Anyway, they hid and watched drivers at a junction in the Bay Area of San Francisco and watched to see you know, when drivers gave way to each other, as they were supposed to do, who took their turn, who cut other people up. And they saw a marked increase in the number of times that people were cut up if you were in a posh car. So the posh drivers, the privileged drivers with the flash cars, did far more cutting up of other drivers. They also failed to stop more for passengers that were trying to cross this junction, for pedestrians trying to cross this junction. So having got this sort of out in the wild work, they then went to the lab and did five more studies there with loads of people from around UC Berkeley, students and older people. And they had them fill out the standard kind of form too, which assesses your socioeconomic class, which is a measure of your occupation, your income and your education. And then they got them to do various tests. I mean, one of the ones I liked, I won't go through all of them because I haven't got time, but one of the ones I liked was they were put in an experiment, a computer experiment, it's supposed to be a game of chance, and they were told beforehand, look, you're going to see a dice roll five times on the computer. I want you to tot up the score. The higher the score you get, the more chance you have of winning some money. And none of the people knew that everybody's score would be 12, okay? But the posher people, the more privileged people, came out and consistently said they scored more than 12
to get the money.
Yeah, because they would just always sort of just lie about what the numbers were, unless they can't add up, which is probably wrong. And so that was just one example. And you know, these experiments were done on hundreds of people in each time. And the author says he finds a fairly consistent effect here.
I think that one of the other lines in the story, which I thought was quite interesting, I'd love to know more, is that about the more privileged people pilfering sweets meant for children in a neighbouring lab. Why would you even do that?
Well, this was another one where they'd actually had another study done, and while they were waiting for something else to happen, all of the people taking part in that test, these were the low and the high sort of class people, were told, look, here's some sweets. They're actually for the children taking part in a study in the neighboring lab. And it was labeled for the children, basically, in the neighboring lab. And they said, look, if you want to take one or two, don't worry about it, it's fine. And then they walked away. But the privileged people took more sweets off the children than the underprivileged children did. What I think, there is one thing I do want to add, which is, the really nice part of this study that they did was they found that if you prime people by telling them that greed is good, essentially getting you to recite, write down three reasons why you think greed is good. It primes the idea in your mind. And then you test people. The less privileged people become as unethical as the more privileged people. So the more privileged people already think of greed as good, according to this study. But the lower privileged ones don't. And it seems to be that difference in outlook that is causing the effect here. And obviously it's not set in stone. You have people like Bill Gates who's shed loads of money and does lovely things with it, and Warren Buffett and so on. But it seemed to be a trend in among the people that were looked at here.
Well, clearly there's something to discuss there. We'll leave all those stories there. If you want to read all of them, they're all at guardian.co.uk/site. Now let's go back to Ian Stewart. One of the most useful mathematical equations, especially in this digital age, is the Fourier transform. It was devised by the French mathematician Joseph Fourier in the early 1800s, and I asked Ian to explain just what has made this equation so indispensable.
The Fourier transform is extraordinarily influential. If you have a mobile phone that can take photographs, as nearly all of them can now, in order to store the information of the picture in a compact form, it uses a version of this Fourier transform. So Fourier was a French mathematician, and what he was interested in was heat. He wanted to understand how heat flows through a body. Imagine taking a metal rod, sticking it in the fire, getting it red hot, and then you say, as time passes, how does the temperature at different points in that rod change as it cools down? And Fourier wrote down an equation for heat flow, but then he wanted to solve it, because this is the big problem with mathematical equations as descriptions of nature. The equation tells you the rules that nature is following, but you can't work out what actually happens unless you solve the equation. You find mathematical quantities that actually fit what the equation is saying, and that's the hard bit. And Fourier came up with a fantastically interesting method, a new method for solving this heat equation, which was to represent the way the temperature varied along the length of the rod in terms of sine curves, in terms of basic, simple up and down oscillations of different frequencies. And what he showed was that if you know what the initial temperature is as one of these Fourier series, certain amount of a sine curve plus a certain amount of a higher frequency sine curve and so on, then you could immediately write down how that temperature profile would change as time passed. And basically, different frequencies give you different, the heat leaks away faster if the frequency is higher. So what emerges from this is a thing called the Fourier transform, which essentially says take something that's defined in space and time, such as the temperature at a given point on the rod at a given instant of time, and instead turn it into a description in terms of frequencies of these component sine curve shapes. That's called the Fourier transform.
And so where does that lead us? Because that sounds, you know, in itself a very philosophical, mathematical tour de force. But then hundreds of years later, we are, as you say, using it to compress pictures. And I mean, that's just one of the millions of places. I mean, computing has really used this everywhere.
Yes. What the Fourier transform does in general terms is say there are two different ways of thinking about this physical quantity, which in Fourier's case was heat flow, but in your digital camera, it's the pattern of light and dark in an image. And it's a two-dimensional image instead of a rod that's being heated. But exactly the same technique works. So you take your digital image. If you turn it into its Fourier transform, there are things you can now do very easily to the Fourier transform, such as take the really high frequency information, which the eye can't distinguish anyway, and just throw it away. So the very, very fine ripples, so to speak, in the Fourier transform, you just literally cross them out of the formula. And then you reconstruct what the picture looks like if you leave them out. Now, it's very hard to do this on the original image, sort of grayscale image, the actual picture. You can't look at a picture and say, oh, I'll tell you how to simplify the information in that picture. But if it's turned into its Fourier transform, which is just a list of numbers, you can say throw away all the high frequency numbers.
So you're storing less information.
So you're storing less information, so you get more picture onto less camera card, you know, which is why when I go on holiday with a 2 gigabyte card, I can take 1,200 images, which look fine on my on a 27-inch computer screen in colour.
Now, we were talking about waves. There is something called the wave equation, which is another one of the equations in your book. It sounds very simple. Tell us about that.
The wave equation started, it was when the mathematicians who were following Leibniz decided to look at what Newton was doing and thought, oh, hey, we can use that. This is we can apply this to physics. And they started moving on from what Newton had done and saying, what else can we use these ideas on? Fourier did it with heat, but what about sound? And sound is a wave. Light is, in fact, a wave, we now know, but they didn't know that then. A violin string vibrating is a wave, and that's about the simplest possible mathematical system to start with. It's just a straight line that's vibrating from side to side. And so they applied Newton's laws of motion, that the acceleration is proportional to the force, to a violin string, where the force is essentially tension in the string. And you write down what happens when you apply this, and you get this beautiful mathematical equation. It's a quite, if you know calculus, it's a very simple, short, compact equation. And then you solve this, and in fact you can use methods rather like Fourier's, and you can find out how an object of a given shape will vibrate. And whenever you see this wave equation, you know that you get this wave-like behavior. So ocean waves, sound, light, things like that. And physicists discovered that light was a wave when another set of equations came along, Maxwell's equations for electricity and magnetism, or combining them for electromagnetism. And a very simple deduction from Maxwell's equations shows that there exists some electromagnetic wave which travels at the speed of light. It's one of those trick questions. What travels at the speed of light?
Light.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
So therefore, the light is an electromagnetic wave. And that's why we have radio, television, wireless computer communications.
So if you spot something in nature that you can fit to this particular pattern of movement, you know it's a wave, even if you don't know anything else about that thing.
That's right. And then you have a whole battery of mathematical techniques to understand those waves and to even, you know, predict sometimes what they're going to do. So earthquakes produce waves in the earth, and the equations describing those are slightly more sophisticated versions of this original wave equation.
Now, equations aren't only useful for scientific purposes. There's probably a I don't know how famous this equation is, but people should probably know about it. And if I say the words black Scholes to you, tell us where that comes from and how it's created the enormous problems that we see around us in the world.
It's often called the Midas equation. It was an equation for turning things into gold. What it was, it was a very sensible idea, and it's actually a good equation. Two economists, Fisher Black and Myron Scholes, wanted to work out how to put a sensible price on a financial option. So an option is a contract to buy or sell some commodity at some fixed future date at some specified price. So I could say to you, OK, I will buy 1,000 tonnes of wheat from you in 6 months' time at $300 a tonne. And there are two versions of this contract. One of them, I have the option of saying, sorry, I don't want that. The other one, I'm basically forced to take it at that price unless you tell me that you don't want me to. Now, those contracts are essentially insurance policies for people who want to buy or sell wheat. But what the financial world realised was, if 2 months into the contract, the person who was going to buy the wheat decided, I'm not really interested in this anymore, I want to sell the contract to somebody else, then that contract becomes a desirable object in its own right.
And can be traded.
It can be traded. But the big question is, what price should you charge? And Fisher and Scholes worked out a mathematical equation to give a kind of sensible, rational price, which in theory was risk-free. This is the price. OK, the market is fluctuating. You don't know exactly where it's going to go. Wheat might be more expensive. It might be cheaper. But you can have a kind of best estimate of what the price ought to be. And if you measure risk in a reasonably sensible way, this is the point at which the risk is essentially, to buyer and seller, is zero.
And so that equation came along in the 80s and 90s, I believe. And then its use exploded as mathematicians entered the city to try and solve it.
It was really, what happened was that the city loved this idea that you could put an agreed industry standard price on a financial instrument before it matured. So the contract itself now became a commodity. I think in some ways the financial markets were kind of trapped by their own invention. You know, they were trading this stuff. Even if tomorrow everyone said, oh, the equation's no good, they'd still have to keep trading it, but now it would be kind of flying by the seat of the pants. And so everyone got locked into, well, we'll use the standard methods because at least that way we can justify what we did. So it's very complex. It's not just the equation's fault. But when the market conditions changed, as they did as the subprime mortgage fiasco started to unfold, and the banks realised that the property they were securing loans against wasn't worth as much as they thought it was going to be, and if they all tried to sell it at the same time, it would be worth even less, then the whole thing started to unravel. And the confidence the equation had given them turned out to be misplaced. And a whole pile of other things they did turned out to be rather silly, and we all saw what happened, and we're still arguing about exactly what's to blame for it.
Ian, thank you very much. Ian Stewart's 17 Equations That Changed the World is published by Profile Books, and it's available now.
That's all we have for this edition of Science Weekly. You can keep up to speed with breaking science news at any time on guardian.co.uk/science. And a quick heads up for your diaries. On March the 28th, we're recording Science Weekly at the historic Faraday Lecture Theatre at the Royal Institution in London. We'd love you to be in the audience. Full details of the show will be unveiled in the coming weeks. But if you want to come along, click on the link on the podcast blog and register for your free tickets. But for now, from me, Alok Chah, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a 1 month, no commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.